Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It's been 2 years to the day since the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, an incident that exposed long-established fault lines of racial division there and across the country. The small North County community became ground zero for a national movement for racial justice and equality. A lot has happened in the 2 years since the shooting, and a lot has not happened. What are the lessons of Ferguson, and how are they being taught? We'll begin with a panel of experts who are literally teaching Ferguson. Dr. Marsha Chatelain is history professor at Georgetown University and the creator of Hashtag Ferguson Syllabus, a Twitter campaign to help educators talk and teach about Ferguson. Kimberly Norwood is professor of law at Washington University and editor of Ferguson Fault Lines, a compendium of thoughtful analysis of Ferguson and its fallout. Dr. Stephen Bradley is director of African American Studies and associate professor of history at St. Louis University. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Chatelain, let me begin with you. How do you approach this subject with today's students?
Well, I think it's really interesting to see just the fundamental changes in my students since 2014 in terms of their relationship to social movements. When I taught my history of civil rights class in the fall of 2013, one of the big questions I opened with is protest dead? And now I could never ask that question because students all around us, regardless of their own thoughts about Black Lives Matter, they have a sense that we are in the middle of a social movement. And so I think for me, the way that I talk about this is how is this moment informing the way that you think about your upbringing, your responsibility as a citizen, and what you are supposed to get out of college education moving forward?
And your reaction, the students' reaction to this has been
fantastic.
What?
I think that students want to come closer to thoughtful analysis about the moment that they're in. One of the things that I find is that for most of my students, they're used to debate in terms of how it's done on cable news, where two people with opposing views kind of yell at each other and then it ends. And so what the classroom provides is an opportunity to introduce nuance and empathy and really clear listening in order for students to sort out the complicated feelings that this moment has presented in front of them.
Kim Norwood, you're smiling as you listen to Dr. Chatelain. Why?
I think for me, I have a different group of students, but her comments reminded me of it really does turn on who you're teaching or who you're talking to in terms of the reception that you get. And so I've actually used the book Ferguson's Fault Lines in different ways. I go around the country talking to lawyers, judges, and educators. And so the reaction I get there, and sometimes just the public, right? I do a lot of public speaking. And the reaction I get in those venues before those crowds is often different from the classroom, what happens with younger people who actually sign up to take my class. So those people are like preaching to the choir in some respects.
Stephen?
Yeah, well, for me, it might be a little bit different. I think in terms of how students receive it, my students were some of the first on the ground, and so I followed them out to the streets, and so I had taught them civil rights. I had taught them about the Black Freedom Movement and that sort of thing, but having experienced this, they can't go back, and so their ability to analyze things now in moments rather than in, you know, in themes and that sort of thing. I think that that's tremendously beneficial for them. I said this back in 2014, and I'll say it till I die, that the Ferguson uprising was probably one of the all-time best civics lessons ever taught. And so by that, I mean people, particularly young people, learned what a city manager is for, what a state representative is for, what a council person is for, an alder person. And so these kinds of lessons can only be taught in these kinds of moments where people can actually feel them.
Are students responsive to what happened and the social injustice that was revealed, having been there for a long time, but before it really came to the surface through all the publicity of my, are they responsive to that? Are they really sensing that they can do something about that?
Yeah, clearly. I think one of the things that we've learned is these students have started to support candidates that speak to those very issues, civically speaking. these students have been in the streets, sometimes mm-hmm. shutting down streets and that sort of thing. But I think one of the most important things that they learned, and Professor Chatelain explained it well, is this empathy. I just left Canfield Drive, where I saw the father of Mike Brown. And for him, you know, for us, it was coming to remember something. For him, it was a feeling. I saw Mike Brown's mother on Sunday and Saturday, and the mothers of many of the young men who had been killed and young women. And that feeling is something that's difficult to teach, but it's something that's better taught now than at any other time.
Kim Norwood, what has been your experience with regard to the young people and the movement toward change?
I've been very excited and happy to see the outpouring from young people. And so that's been a positive, because I think for so long people were developing this I don't care, it doesn't affect me attitude. And there was something very jarring about what happened on August 9th of 2014 that really changed that, hopefully for all time. Unfortunately, though, in law school, for example, I teach classes other than the first year of law school, which is sort of mandatory required courses. Everything else is sort of elective. And so the people who would sign up to take a class where they would learn about Ferguson often are people who are already moved and interested in those issues. And so one of my goals is to really try to create something that's mandatory, right? Something that all first-year law students would have to take, because this is a part of what the profession would require in terms of preparing professionals to represent people in the future. Okay. So I'm hoping to do something like that.
Marsha, young people clearly are the key to whatever progress is going to be made. There's no question about that. But should Ferguson lessons be taught at a much earlier age than higher education?
Absolutely. When I started to ask people on Twitter to devote the first day of classes to Michael Brown and the children of Ferguson who wouldn't have a normal first day of school, I really wanted for educators to realize that there's always age-appropriate, climate-specific conversations about race and injustice that you can have. And so with a 3 or 4-year-old, it may be explaining that people may look different, but we want to treat them equally. And for older kids, it's helping them sort through the raw emotions of injustice and violence. And for older students, it may be looking at the history and the roots of how a town like Ferguson emerges and the impact of factors like poverty and disenfranchisement. And so, of course, this is a conversation that should be had through all levels, because young people of all ages feel the tension, they feel the anxiety, and they feel the grief of these moments. And so I've been incredibly proud to see the way that teachers on all levels have integrated the materials from Ferguson syllabus and other efforts to really make more meaningful this moment for their students.
And Kim, that has to begin in the home as well.
Yeah, well, as she was talking, I was thinking, you know, it's great to see that, and I'm really excited about that, and I have come in contact with some teachers here who have done that, but my hope would be that this wouldn't be just teacher-led. I mean, you really do want something in the curriculum that isn't dependent on some teacher who has this sense that, oh, yeah, my students need to know about these issues, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's hopefully where we would see this move.
Is the material out there to be able to do that yet?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. I think one of the things that's special about this moment is the ability to read it in all the newspapers and all the magazines, on all the websites and this sort of thing. Educators, we view these things as prizes. As an historian, this will be a precious, precious moment. I don't know how we'll figure out how to read all the tweets, all of the Facebook postings and all that sort of thing. But the evidence, the all the different thoughts are there. There was another thing I wanted to say, though, about in teaching this. We forget that school started late for these young people out there in Ferguson. And so if we're going to teach this, we have to teach it right. That is that the young people couldn't go to sleep at night because of the helicopters, that the tear gas and that sort of thing was coming through the air conditioning units. And when they did go to school, this is another thing that a lot of people don't remember, is some of these students couldn't talk about what was happening on the street at mm-hmm. school. And so it took a moment before people could get to the point where they could discuss this.
Well, you said something that's interesting in terms of, as a historian and as a committed individual, that you can read the newspapers. But we're also reading in the newspapers today, thanks to our politicians at all levels, that seems to be counter, your turn, you know what I'm getting at. It seems to be counterproductive to what we're talking about here today and what a lot of people want to come out of the Ferguson experience. Law and order, and America is a crime scene and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that, the influence that is going to have on the young people that we're talking about?
Well, I'll just speak briefly and let the law professor take it after that. But in seriousness, this is what you see throughout history, is when you see these moments of people rising up, the first thing that happens is this focus on order and law and that sort of thing. Not keeping in mind we cherry pick the order and the laws that we want to care about.
It's code.
Yeah, absolutely, and dog whistle kind of politics.
Kim?
Well, this is exactly why telling the story is so important. This is exactly why making the record is so important. I mean, the facts are the facts, right? And so this is part of the reason why we are in the mess we're in, because quite frankly, history has not been taught in American public schools. I mean, it's a huge fault and failure. And so people have grown up not even knowing what the Confederate flag means, how it looks, what it stands for, right? And so it's very important to document this and to get this out there. And this, not only that, but to get it into schools, to get it into the curriculums, because otherwise people grow up with, you know, these fairy tales.
And get it into the curriculum early.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Marcia, your take on that, this whole law and order thing that's permeating politics today.
Right. So this is part of the cycle of progress and backlash. And so, you know, the only reason we're able to have a presidential candidate like Donald Trump, and the only reason why law and order can resonate today, is because we've seen progress in the past. And so I think that what I am most impressed by with Black Lives Matter is that they are constantly resisting these counter-narratives to the questions about accountability and what does justice look like and what does freedom look like. And I think for young people, they are understanding this pendulum of change and regression. They saw it with the election of the first Black president. And so I think that we are in a key moment in which, in a very short period of time, we've seen that kind of backlash, and we can really illustrate it to young people that this is one of the consequences of change, but it should never deter us.
I have to take a break now. I want to come back to you on a point there, Marcia Chatelain, and we'll do so in a moment. We're talking about Ferguson 2 years after the shooting death of Michael Brown. Marcia Chatelain is with us from Georgetown University. Kim Norwood is editor of the Ferguson Fault Lines book and also a law professor. And Stephen Bradley is associate professor of history at St. Louis University. We'll be back in just a moment to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation. Marcia, I'm going to turn back to you, if I may. You're the Twitter person, the social media person of the moment here, given what you've been doing. We received a tweet today that is hard for me to even read back to you, but I want to get your reaction to it and the reaction of the others. And that was, "The world is better off without Michael Brown." It's a difficult thing to have to say on this date in particular, but that represents a certain point of view that is out there.
Right. So one of the things about social media, particularly Twitter, is that it has this incredible capacity to get people from disparate corners of the world talking about the same things and engaging. And it's also a space in which people decide that this is where all their vitriol can be unleashed. And so I think that the person who probably tweeted that out maybe would never say that in polite company, maybe they would. But the fact that we have these digital spaces for people to be their most aggressive and their most terrible also is chastening in moments like this. And I think it's unfortunate, as a family grieves the loss of a son and a friend, this is the type of expression that someone is moved to have. But I think that what it drives home is the fact that although our digital spaces allow us to do some things more efficiently, at the end of the day, it's people-to-people contact and community that ultimately is the most important thing.
Kim, you have any thoughts about that, the whole social media part of this?
Well, again, I agree. There's so many positives. There's so many negatives. I mean, it could be used for good. It could be used for bad. I personally have experienced vitriol from people who feel very free and at liberty to say all kinds of horrible things from their computer, right, when they don't have to really be in your face and face the music. And so that's a horrible downside to the social media thing. As you read the tweet, I mean, it just brought up anger and pain, right? Simultaneously. I mean, it just is unbelievable that this person doesn't know Mike Brown. Nobody really does, right? But based on these little blips and excerpts, I'm assuming it's a he, and I don't know that, but I'm getting the sense that, you know, this person has no value. Like, what does that mean, right? And that's what he's saying when he says we're better off without him. That means he had no value, and that's deeply troubling.
Okay. Yeah, Well, thank goodness for social media, I'll say that to begin with. But there's really two points that I wanted to make when you read the tweet. The first is the boy was 18 years old. We don't know who he would have been. And I think about El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, who by 18 people would have considered a complete thug, but went on to lead people and to educate people and try to move this nation towards justice. I'm speaking about Malcolm X, of course. Yeah. And then the second part of it is we sure are playing fast and loose with our feelings about citizens. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem, is we have a hard time thinking of people who grow up in the Canfield Green apartment complex and who attend unaccredited schools as citizens. If we did, we would probably be more careful about the way that we speak about them, the way that we care for them, and that sort of thing. If citizens were being treated the same way that some of the people in North St. Louis and East St. Louis, if they were being treated that way, I often say it, we would send rescue squads to come and get them and that sort of thing. And we've lost track of that. And that's why people can sit behind a phone or a computer screen and tweet these kind of nonsensical things.
I wonder how this situation might have played out had Michael Brown been white and the circumstances been exactly the same. Kim, have you given any thought to that?
Yeah, so I actually have been sort of keeping track of police interactions, police encounters with often white males versus black males and the results. And time after time after time, we see completely different responses. And so people say to me all the time, well, you know, police are under pressure. They have to act in milliseconds and they don't have time and it's life or death. And I get that, absolutely. But for some reason, when the person on the other side of that gun is a white male, there's more time for deliberation. Those guys end up getting a trial. They end up living. And so the fear that's generated, I mean, it's real. I got it. I'm not a police officer because it's really dangerous work, right? So I get it. I'm not, you know, I wouldn't sign up for it. And I thank them for their work. But at the same time, there is a different way of reacting. We see, you know, 6 hours for example, with Robert Deere, the person who killed all of those people at Planned Parenthood, had an AK rifle, shot and killed people, pointed the gun at police, and he is getting a trial. Laquan McDonald got 6 seconds. There's a difference. Laquan McDonald had a knife.
And that's played out in many different ways.
Yes,
I think
absolutely.
Of the many examples we have where a pretty white child is abducted and a pretty black child is abducted, it's front page news for a long time and
mountains.
On all the television sets for the white girl, but not for the black. Marcia, any thoughts on all of this?
Well, I think that, you know, it's not just about the incidents that happen between people of color and the police. It's the world that people of color disproportionately inhabit. And so for us to imagine if Michael Brown was a different skin color, there are so many material conditions about his life that would be different. And I think that that is the point, and that is the lesson that this moment is trying to teach us. What are the systems that are so deeply entrenched that these incidents help magnify a series of conditions, as Professor Bradley was talking about, in terms of accredited schools, as we see in places like Baltimore and Flint, lead in the water, you know, vulnerability in terms of joblessness. And so I think that, if anything, what the Movement for Black Lives has done for all of us is to say that these incidents are part of a larger problem, that if we really want to do the work of justice, it isn't a matter of reforming protocols between citizens and the police. It's about really reforming the world that we live in.
Yeah.
Well, and this is exactly what my book is about, right? Like, it really is attempted to, and I hope successfully, took lots of the pieces to the pie. And so we have a chapter that deals with the public education system. We have a chapter that deals with public health, mental health, economics, segregated housing. All of these things contributed to the explosion that we saw in Ferguson and what we see throughout the country.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I notice in particular about your book, that it doesn't focus on one thing, because what we're talking about is many, many things covering the entire spectrum of this social world. Let's get a couple of calls. Some people want to get into this conversation. We'll bring them in, and we'll start with Scott from Chesterfield. I think we'll make a point that the Professor Bradley made here a moment ago. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, we have a congressperson, Daryl Issa, who used to be a car thief. So you don't know what's going to happen with you. People do, they do reform. I've heard people on the radio that say they used to, when they were young, they were criminals, you know, and a lot of it has to do, you know, there's a lot of homeless kids and, you know, abused kids and, you know, foster kids. And, you know, it's just, I don't know. So, you know, people reform.
Sure.
And I think I read in the Washington Post that, like, blacks are 5 or 7 times more likely to be shot by police, and there have been different studies done, and I think something needs to change. You know, I mean, the police, the unions, and the police chief organization, they don't like the protocols to try to reduce police shootings. And
Scott, we have the point. I'm going to have to move on and get some. Anybody want to address what Scott has told us?
Yeah, no, thank you for the point, Scott. And I think one of the things that as long as we're imagining things, why don't we try to invert the entire situation and have it so we're imagining black police shooting a young white person. That's hard and very difficult to imagine, because that doesn't happen hardly ever. And so this is the point that a lot of people are making, that it's so regular to get this police shooting, sometimes white police shooting black youth and black people, that we don't have to imagine that at all. But inverting the entire situation would be tough. And the point about not knowing who somebody's going to be by the time they're 18 is just an important one, and it's one that we should remember.
Alrighty, anybody else want to comment on that? One final. Go ahead, Marcia.
I think that the killing of Michael Brown and the killing of Tamir Rice and others also has brought the point about the importance of understanding Black children and youth as children and youth, and the way that law enforcement and others have misread Black children, and a point that was made after Michael Brown was killed, and people were reflecting on the killing of Trayvon Martin, is that people always think of Black children as scary, yes, instead of possibly scared. And I think that your caller brought home that point that we rarely are able to forgive young people for being young people when they're young people of color.
All right. Well, thank you for making that point. The issue that we started this discussion with concerned teaching young people and getting them to respond to what is being taught and what the situation has been over the last couple of years since Michael Brown's death. The question is, the speed with which change, if it's going to happen, is going to happen. Nicole, I'm just having a brain cramp here. Nicole Hudson has said recently that it took decades for this situation to develop. It's going to take decades to solve. Do you agree with that, Kim?
I would have said no when I first wrote the book. And as I dug deep into history and I see this happening periodically in our history, mm-hmm, I am very worried about how long it's going to take. I do see some light at the end of the tunnel, but I think it's going to take a long time. Even though we have lots of young people that are galvanized and moving forward, you know, implicit bias is real and it is ingrained in our DNA, and it's very hard to make people conscious of their biases and to interrupt them. And so we have a lot of work to do, but it can be done.
Yeah. Stephen?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to be contrary, but history happens in moments. It really does. Mm-hmm. And so when these tragedies occur, legislators are much more willing to move quickly than ever before. All of a sudden, it's important to everybody. In schools, all of a sudden, they want to have curriculum discussions about how to talk about these kinds of things. So taking advantage of the moment, you know, history, these big plates and people who slide in between them are the ones that manage to make the memories of history. And so with that in mind, I think some of the triumphs of the movement thus far are in the way of some of these revisions to the fining policies in the area. Those are victories, and they wouldn't have come about otherwise. In addition, there's all kinds of what I call Mike Brown positions in higher education that have come about as well, where people are able to talk about diversity in ways where never before they were able to do so.
And when you look at the body cameras, for example, you know, and you look at Eric Gardner, I mean, certainly we said, if we have video, right, there's going to be a different outcome. That hasn't happened yet. Yeah. Even after Mike Brown was shot, I mean, I really thought there was going to be a tremendous change in that. I didn't think we would continue to see unarmed Black men and women being shot, and they are, right? And so the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Of course, you got to turn those body cameras on. And there's been an incident recently where that somehow didn't happen. Marsha, let me give you the last word on this. We're going to have to move on.
Well, I think that I don't know how long it's going to take, but I think our conversations about what it takes have gotten better, mm-hmm, in the past 2 years. I think that, you know, there's all this nonsense about a Ferguson effect in a negative sense, because now, you know, everyday citizens are just so anti-police, and that's not real. But I do think that there's something I like to call the Ferguson affect, and I think that we have a generation of organizers and young people that are leading this country, that are teaching us how to grieve, reminding us to have joy in these moments, and also teaching us a valuable lesson about people left behind and situations that have been unattended to. And so I don't know how long it will take, but every day as I spend time with young people, they're teaching me what's at stake and what it's going to take to create change.
Well, we'll end it on that note. And I want to thank you so much, Marsha Shadlin of Georgetown University, for being with us today. Kim Norwood, professor of law at Washington University, and the editor of the book, Ferguson Fault Lines. Thank you for being with us. And Stephen Bradley of St. Louis University, great to see you again. Thank you all so much. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.